Dave Kiefer is on staff at the Submakers, been on staff much longer than I have. He's my boss, my good friend. And you guys are in for a treat to hear him teach tonight. It's going to be awesome. So I'm just going to sit down and enjoy.
It's good to be back. You guys, ready for the spring semester? I tell you, I hate long nights and short days. Do you guys get up and it's still dark? Isn't that the most depressing thing in the world, to get up and it's dark? Like, when you wake up, it's supposed to be bright. It's supposed to be bright, so I cannot wait for daylight savings time and all that good stuff. It's good to be back with you. Like Andy said, I'm Dave. I work with these guys in Disciple Makers, and I travel around to the different campuses. And we're going to be starting a new series through the book of Exodus. Exodus is just one of the most powerful stories in the Old Testament. It's about God delivering his people from oppression, and real oppression. It doesn't get much worse than the way the Israelites were treated. They were enslaved. They were abused. They were robbed from. And, chances are, if you're in this room tonight, you haven't suffered from the oppression of slavery. But we all suffer from different types of oppression. Racism, sexism, maybe abuse from parents, just maybe gossip and slander in relationships, maybe just the oppression of sort of a broken, sinful nature and of addictions that you wrestle with. And so we are going to be talking throughout this entire semester of how the God of the Bible, the God of Christianity, enters into our world to really free us from our oppression. And I get to start, so I'm going to give you a little bit of context about the Exodus and how God is going to bring his people who are in slavery in Egypt, out of that slavery into a promised land. He promises to be their God and to give them their freedom. And I want to tell you a little bit about the history of Israel. I want to talk about three things: the blessings of Israel, the sufferings of Israel, and then the God of Israel. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to read the passage and just comment on it as we go through. Sound good? All right, here we go. First, the blessings of Israel. Let's look at Exodus chapter 1, starting at verse 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household. That would mean his wife and kids. So there's Reuben, Simeon, Levi. These are all the sons of Jacob. Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin. Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, and Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. First of all, let's talk about the blessings of Israel. Two things. One, the blessings upon Israel before they get oppressed in slavery in Egypt, the blessings upon Israel were undeniable and undeserved. First, undeniable. Look at verse 6 and 7, right? They grew exceedingly strong so that the world was filled with them, right? God had grown these people in strength, in numbers, in status, and in wealth. In those days, in an agricultural society, right, what everyone wanted was fertility, right? You wanted a fertile womb, you wanted fertile fields, you wanted fertile cattle, because that was the way you had security and protection and wealth and status. And you see right here in verse 6 and 7 that God just blesses them and makes them fruitful and increases them, not modestly, but greatly. And he multiplies them over and over and over again. They start out with these 12 sons of Jacob and with the wives and kids. It says there that there's 70 of them, right? And within a couple generations, there's like millions. I mean, God's blessings are just undeniable. They're so abundant that the Egyptians, in a couple generations later, right, they grow jealous of them and threatened by them. So that's the first thing. The blessings were completely undeniable. Second, their blessings were undeserved. How so? Well, let's take a look at who these people are, right? It says, these are the names of the sons of Israel. Now, who's Israel? Israel is the name of Jacob. Jacob wrestled with God, and through that, God renamed him Israel. Now, Jacob was a scoundrel. You might remember when we went over in Genesis, right, that Jacob cheated his brother out of the blessing, out of the birth order blessing. What is it? The primogeniture thing? Yeah, the birthright. Thank you. Couldn't think of, yeah. My mind's a little tired tonight. The birthright, right? He lied to his father in order to do that. He was a polygamist who provoked his many wives to jealousy by playing favorites and playing favorites with his kids. He tolerated idol worship. So that's Jacob. Now let's look at the sons of Jacob, right? Reuben, Simeon, Levi. We have 11 sons of Jacob who are mentioned in verse 2. But then you get down to verse 5 and you see the 12th son, Joseph, was already in Egypt. Now, what happened there? This is a dysfunctional family. If any of you think your family is dysfunctional, you haven't met the family of Jacob, okay? So the reason why Joseph was already in Egypt is because his father played favorites, and he doted on Joseph, and he gave him a special coat of many colors, and Joseph was a pompous brag. I mean, he was a jerk, going around bragging about how he's a favorite. He had gotten a vision from God about how great he's going to be, and he's sharing with his brothers, and his brothers burn with so much jealousy. I mean, they want to shut him up. And it gets so bad at one point, they're tempted to murder him, but the oldest intervenes and says, you know what, let's not murder him, but let's sell him off as a slave. There's some Ishmaelites coming by. At least we can make some money, and my conscience would be appeased. So they actually sell their brother in slavery. And he goes down to Egypt, and he lives in Potiphar's house, and then he gets accused of doing bad things he didn't do. He gets thrown in jail, or he interprets dreams, and through that whole experience, Pharaoh gets his name, and he interprets some dreams for Pharaoh, and he saves all Egypt, and that's why he's down there. Okay, but the point is, dysfunctional family. I mean, how would you feel if your brother was so angry with you that they wanted to kill you? Instead of killing you, they just sell you to the sex slave. You know, sex slave. I mean, this is bad stuff, okay? So, and then Simeon and Levi, the first two guys mentioned. Let's just briefly talk about them. These guys had a sister, Dinah, and one man had sexually violated their sister, Dinah. So you know what they do? They took justice in their own hands, and they slaughtered all the men of Shechem, where this guy was from. Nice guys. How about Judah? Judah, the fourth brother there. Judah thought it's no big deal to sleep with prostitutes. But he's willing to kill his daughter-in-law, Tamar, when it's discovered she's pregnant out of wedlock. What a stinking hypocrite. And he shows mercy on Tamar only after he discovers that he was the father of Tamar's baby. You can't make this stuff up. And I know, you're thinking, how can you not know you slept with your daughter-in-law and got her pregnant? But he did, because she dressed like a cult prostitute, which means he was engaged in sort of like an orgy of worshiping pagan gods, and the prostitutes are veiled so you don't really see their faces. This is Judah. And God says, these are my people, and I want to bless them. These murderers, these adulterers, these hypocrites, these liars, these idolaters, these polygamists, these cheats. My people. And I'm going to multiply them and bless them and turn them into a great nation. See, God blesses them despite their family brokenness, their pet jealousies, their folly, their manipulations, their hypocrisy, and their nauseating, destructive, oppressive sin. And he just lavishes blessing on them. What does this mean? Listen to me very carefully. God blesses those who don't deserve it. And he blesses them abundantly. Why? Well, he's merciful. He's loving. He's gracious. He demonstrates the glories of his abundant mercy by blessing those who really don't deserve it. Why else does he bless those who really don't deserve it? Well, when it comes to inventory of the human race, everyone has issues and brokenness and sin and hypocrisy. And so, truth be told, none of us deserve God's blessings. Israel was no different. Every family, every tribe is characterized by complicated dysfunction and sin, every person, at least in some way. And yet God decides to bless because he's merciful and gracious. So how does this apply? Be humble, but not despairing. Be humble. Are you living a good life? Do you feel blessed? Are you successful? Do you have a lot of status and wealth? Have you sitting there going, yeah, man, I've made it. You know, I've worked hard to get what I have. I would encourage you to take a second look that while, yes, you worked hard to get your 3.5, there are so many blessings you've been given that you did not earn, work for, or deserve. Advantages that you've been given. I'm looking at most of you, and most of you, except a couple, are from the majority white culture. Okay? And you have so many blessings just from that, that you don't even realize. You get benefits, right? When you're walking down the street, the cops don't, maybe aren't as suspicious of you, right? When you grew up, you got Band-Aids that match your color, skin color, right? I mean, all these things, just little things that are advantages to you. Maybe you grew up in the suburbs, and it was just a safer environment, right? See, where we're born, who our parents are, what time we're born, the fact, stinking, we're born in the 21st century. If you were born 100 years ago, one-fifth of you would have died in childbirth. The other fifth of you would have died by now because you would have had some kind of asthma or something. Remember the times you went to the doctor and you kind of lived in your childhood? Well, you wouldn't have if it was 100 years ago. Some of you, you've just been protected because you haven't been sexually abused or emotionally abused or physical abused, or you grew up in a two-family home. These are things you did not deserve, and yet they give you an emotional stability so that when you study, you can focus. So humble yourself and don't say, well, I just work harder than you. Do you know the challenges other people face because they grew up in a very unsafe environment? Maybe they were born with fetal alcohol syndrome. Maybe they were abused sexually. Maybe they are being currently abused emotionally. It is so hard for them to concentrate on biology because of that. So humble yourself. Yes, you know, be proud of your accomplishments, but humble yourself and recognize so much of what you have is because God's been merciful and just blessed you. He's given you the brain, the body, all the gifts and talents you have, the opportunities you have to be here at college. All of you are here at college, which means you are in the top 5% of advantage and privilege compared to the rest of the people in the world. So be humble, but don't despair. This is the other side of the application. Have you messed up? Have you done things that are so shameful, maybe in relationships with someone of the opposite sex, that's just so dysfunctional, so shameful, maybe you've done things that you're not even ready to talk about, and you're so afraid, I've messed up any chances of having a healthy relationship, of getting married. Do not fear, do not despair. God's blessings are undeserved. There's nothing you've done, no mistakes, no past, nothing that you've been through, nothing, you haven't screwed up so bad that God can't and won't bless you. Why? Because his blessings are undeserved. And so be humble, but never despairing. So the blessings of Israel, they were undeserved and they were undeniable. The sufferings of Israel, we're going to read that in verse 8 through 16. They're also undeniable and undeserved. Look at verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, Behold, the people of Israel, too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more the Israelites were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad, and the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. And so they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves, and they made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick, and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of them who was named Shiprah and the other Puah, he said, when you serve as a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live. Wow. The sufferings of Israel were undeniable. Just notice, in verse 11, it's systematic oppression, right? They set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. That was planned. That was systematized. It's also exploitive. At the second half of verse 11, they're building store cities for Pharaoh called Pithom and Ramses, and others were benefiting from their labor. They weren't allowed to benefit from their own sweat equity. Everyone else benefited, not them, so it was exploitive. It was also incremental. Look at verse 12. It says, but the more they were oppressed. In other words, the oppression increased over time. It got worse and worse and worse until in verse 13, it's ruthless. Verse 14, bitter and hard. So it's systematic, it's exploitive, it's incremental. Fourth, it's long. It happened over generations, 400 years. That is a long time to suffer. That is grandpa and great-grandpa and great-grandpa. I mean, just you can't even remember a time when you were free. And last, it's deadly. Verse 16, they kill all the newborn boys. The sufferings of Israel were as undeniable at this stage in their history as their blessings were undeniable previously. What does this mean? Sometimes people suffer overwhelmingly and undeniably at the hands of others. And that means we can't live in denial. How does this apply for us? Listen, we need to sober up to the reality of oppression. For those of you in the room who've been spared from abuse or neglect, or you live in the majority culture, it's just so easy for us to think this doesn't happen anymore. Right? I'm a white guy. It's easy for me to think, do cops really pull people over and are suspicious of them just because of their race? That doesn't happen anymore. But I have dearly beloved black friends that tell me, yes, it still happens. That this is what Black Lives Matter movement is about. They see things, they feel things, oppressions that most of us white guys, that doesn't happen anymore. Come on. You must have done something to deserve it. Because I'm a white guy. I mean, the only reason I get pulled over is because I did something to deserve it. No, that's unjust oppression. Systematized racism, it still exists. We can't live in denial of this. It's easy to doubt this stuff really happens. It's easy to say, slavery doesn't exist anymore in the world. Yeah, it does. We have thousands, tens of thousands of slaves in America. Did you know that? In our city, sex slavery is running rampant. Right through Reading, Pennsylvania is a huge area. A lot of this stuff is happening in terms of where they're trafficking people. It's happening in our own state. And that means as Christians, as believers of the Bible, we should have a sober view of reality. When we hear someone tell about their abuse, our immediate response should have been like, no way. No way. I can't believe you. But it should be, yeah, man, this has been happening for a long time. Tell me more. We should assume oppression is real. Why? Sin is real. The Bible drives this point home and home and home, home again and again and again the undeniable reality of sin. So I'm a little tired when I do my, I get verbally blah, blah. Right? Suffering was, their suffering was undeniable. Israel's suffering, but it was also undeserved. Okay, we already talked about how Israel as a family was dysfunctional. They weren't a perfect people. But really, they posed no threat to Egypt. In fact, all they had been was a blessing to Egypt. And the only reason why they are oppressed was because they provoked Pharaoh to jealousy through their fruitfulness. And he became fearful because of their growing strength. And he was ignorant because he forgot who Joseph was and all the benefits that Joseph had provided and the Israelites had provided for Israel. And so there was nothing that they had done to deserve being oppressed and treated so harshly. It's just what happens oftentimes when people live in close proximity who often are from different cultures, different races, and ignorance arises, and jealousies arise, and suspicions arise, and slowly doubt replaces trust, and fear and pride take over. And the Pharaoh, in verses 9 through 11, he makes a preemptive strike at the Israelites. And in Pharaoh's eyes, Israel's main crime was, I don't know who these people are, and they're really, really strong, and I'm really, really jealous. And his goal was to limit their power, he says, to keep them from multiplying because he was afraid. And the reason he wanted to manage them was because he wanted to take advantage. He was selfish. He wanted to use the power they had for his own purposes. He doesn't want them to escape in verse 10. So the interpretation, what's this all mean? While Israel's oppression was truly undeserved, the oppressor justified himself. The king of Egypt, did you notice throughout the passage, he positions himself as a possible victim of an unrealized future. Well, they could possibly victimize us in some future date by partnering with our enemies and fighting against us. He assumes the worst without any justifiable reason other than his own fear, pride, and ignorance. But as soon as he positions himself as a possible victim, he sets himself up as an actual perpetrator. Let me say that again. As soon as he positions himself as a possible victim, he sets himself up as an actual perpetrator. And he no doubt views himself as wise, right? He talks about how he's being shrewd. He's shrewd in doing this. He's like a shrewd politician, a protector of the people, a force of good, right? We got to get this under control before these scary people hurt us. Oppressors always have their reasons, their justifications. It's true for Egyptian kings, for southern plantation owners, for Nazi leaders, for communist dictators, for American politicians, for bossy employees, for abusive spouses, abusive parents, and for slandering friends. The descent into oppression often begins because the oppressor is assuming the worst for no good reason, taking on the role of a possible victim to justify a preemptive strike and to be an actual perpetrator. So how does this apply? Be careful of ignorance. Be careful of jealousy. Be careful of your pride. Be careful of your fear. Some of us are fearful people, and we tend to assume a victimhood that hasn't yet happened. And in the name of being safe and protecting ourselves and protecting others, we often become perpetrators by being the first to make a preemptive strike. And that's sin. It's very natural, and it doesn't just happen between classes and between genders and between sexes. It just happens in friendship. I do it with my wife. Oh, I know what she's thinking. She's thinking the worst of me. Pow! Humble yourself. Be aware of the dangers of prematurely claiming victimhood, prematurely giving into your fears, your pride, your jealousies, your ignorance. So the sufferings of Israel were undeserved. The sufferings of Israel were undeniable. Well, who's the God of Israel in the midst of their blessings and in the midst of their suffering? Let's look at verses 17 through 22. It says this, "But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, 'Why have you done this? And let the male children live.' And the midwives said to Pharaoh, 'Because the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They're vigorous. And they give birth before the midwives come to them.'" So God dwelt well with the midwives, and the people of Israel multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. But then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live." So who's the God of Israel? In the midst of Israel's blessings and in the midst of their sufferings, God is undeniably in control. Let me say that again. God is undeniably in control of both the blessings and the sufferings that his people experience. We already saw how God provides undeserved and undeniable blessings, how he grew and he strengthened Israel abundantly, so much so that Pharaoh becomes jealous and threatened. But while Pharaoh is the one choosing to do evil to Israel, God remains in control of Israel's sufferings. He's in control of their sufferings, not just their blessings. In fact, God foretold that Israel would suffer enslavement for hundreds of years before it happened. Where did he say this? If you go back in Genesis 15, at the very moment God takes Abram aside. He takes Abram aside. He makes a covenant with Abram. He says, "Abram, I'm going to be your God. You're going to be my people. I'm going to be your shield and your reward. And I'm going to bless you with so many descendants that they're going to number more than the stars in the sky. And I'm going to give you a land flowing with milk and honey." And at that very moment, he says this, "But know for certain, Abraham, that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own. They will be enslaved and mistreated 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves. And afterwards, they will come out with great possessions." What's the summary? God is in control of all the blessings you experience in life. Now that's an easy pill to swallow. Yeah, God's in control of my blessings. He's good, he's powerful, and he's showering down his blessings. But God is also in control of all the sufferings in your life. And that is a hard pill to swallow. It's easy for us to see God in control of the blessings, but it's another thing to admit that he's in control of our sufferings. And while that's a hard pill to swallow, it's the only medicine that can redeem us from our suffering. It's the only hope that we have that our suffering isn't simply random, chaotic, and therefore meaningless. And the fact that God is in control of both our blessings and our sufferings is the only hope we have that suffering has a purpose and that God can actually do something about it. That he can redeem it, he can end it, he can transform it. Now, if you don't already know, there's a whole lot of physical discourse and discussion about what I'm talking about, the problem of suffering. More books than I can count for hundreds and thousands of years have been written concerning the problem of suffering. I've read a bunch. And the problem of suffering presents a huge dilemma. Many understandably regard the problem of suffering as the best evidence against an all-loving and all-powerful God. In other words, God can't be all-loving and all-powerful at the same time and still allow the suffering he allows. And many think that's more of a a powerful argument against Christianity than arguments from science or arguments from church history with its checkered past of injustice. And I've spoken a lot on this philosophically, and if you want, there's a whole hour-long tape where I talked about the suffering God allows, and you can look at it on the Disciple Makers website under our last conference that we did. But time does not allow me here to address all the philosophical concerns. My goal tonight is simply to present what the Bible teaches about the God of the Bible, the God of Christianity, to show that the Bible, as God's self-revelation, shows us God is in control of our sufferings, not just our blessings, undeniably so. Remember, God predicted the sufferings of Israel all the way back in Genesis 15. So God is undeniably in control of both blessings and sufferings. And that should give us hope, because that means they're not meaningless, they're not chaotic, that God is actually doing something purposeful. They can have meaning, and he can actually do something to relieve and redeem it. But more than God having control over those things, God is not just a God of power, he's a God of love. God loves the Israelites, graciously loves them, undeservedly so, and his love, which is easy to see during times of blessing, seasons of blessing. I mean, who doesn't love God when you're like loving life? I mean, Blake said it tonight. I'm so angry with God. When was he angry with God? When everything was going well? No, it's when life crushed in on him and took away his mom at age 11. Could we ever make sense of that? I don't want to even pretend to have the answer for that one. But God is just as real and just as loving during our times of suffering, even if we don't have a quid pro quo, this for that reason, for exactly why it happened. How do we see this in the passage? First, God intervenes on behalf of the oppressed. God intervenes on behalf of the oppressed. Look at it. Notice how God intervenes by limiting those who cause the oppression, right? He limits Pharaoh. He frustrates Pharaoh. Pharaoh, who is like the all-powerful one in Egypt, is kind of beaten by a bunch of women, midwives, who come up with just a great reason. Well, you know, those Hebrew women, they just, boy, they're rugged. Right? So he limits those who cause oppression, but he also rewards those who fight against oppression. So you see, the midwives are rewarded. God protects them for standing up and doing the right thing. But not only that, he blesses them. It says he blesses them with families of their own. Third, he identifies closely with the severely oppressed. Twice, Pharaoh says, every son must be killed. But in verse 22, he says, every son must be cast into the Nile. Every son killed. There's nothing more painful as losing a child. That's not how it's supposed to be. You're supposed to bury your parent, not your child. And I've been to a bunch of funerals. I've been to funerals of grandparents. I was at a funeral of my dad in April. And the closer someone gets to you, the more painful it is. It's so painful to go to the funeral of a friend from college, but I can't imagine going to the funeral of my wife or my son. You know, put me in a white coat, drug me up, because I'm not going to be able to handle it. That is painful. And the pain doesn't go away. To have a son die. And it's hard enough to have a son die of natural causes, but to have one taken from you, abused, cast away, murdered, that makes it all the more painful. I cannot imagine that. But while I cannot imagine that, the God of the Israelites can personally relate to that one. This God also had a son. And this son was abused, betrayed, mocked. He was nailed to a cross and murdered. And this only son of God was given the most excruciating death you could ever imagine. So God knows what this is like. He identifies closely with those who've been severely oppressed. He's the only God that anyone has ever spoken about or talked about that loves so much that he doesn't just give you proverbs about suffering or ways to methods for how to get through suffering. He actually enters into the suffering. He shares the suffering. He takes the suffering into himself. He identifies that closely. When you love someone, don't you want to carry their suffering? You know, when my wife was sick, I just remember her, you know, feeling horrible. And I'm just like, oh, you know, honestly, I would rather be sick than you. I wish I could take this from you. It's killing me to watch you suffer. That's what love does. And that's the God of the Bible. It's killing me to watch you. Let me take your suffering on myself. And he's taking it not just so that he can identify with it, not just so he can sympathize with us, but so that he can end it. Listen, I don't know why Blake's mom died when he was 11. But I do know God promises to come and end death. And he did it through Jesus Christ. Death does not have the final say. God's end game has not been played out. Someday, there will never be a mom who dies when her son is 11. And I can't wait for that day. And that day, the appetizer of it has been given to us in the person of Jesus Christ when he rose from the grave. After suffering undeniably and undeservedly on a cross. God remains in control during our suffering. And he remains all-loving and all-powerful, not just during good times, but during the worst. And it doesn't mean we'll understand exactly why certain suffering happens, but we can know something about the character and love of God, and we can trust him. How's that apply? Trust in God, who's in control. In control of your blessings, in control of your sufferings. He's not surprised by the good, the bad, or the ugly. He sometimes even predicts it. Jesus Christ himself said, in this world you will have many troubles. We're often surprised, but God is not. Look for ways that God is intervening, how he limits those who cause oppression, like he did with Pharaoh, and how he rewards those who fight against oppression, and partner with him in intervening to stop oppression. Trust him. Trust him. Because God does not simply call you to deal with it and give you methods for dealing with it. He enters into your suffering. He identifies with those who've suffered. He has been oppressed. So he can sympathize. He's with us. He's walked in our shoes. But more than that, he's done it so that he can end it. You and I may never know why we suffer, but we can still trust in the God who we know loves us through all suffering and will end it. Let's pray. God, thanks for this Exodus story that gives us answers that make sense, that just reflect life as we know it. We know suffering is real, that it is harsh, that it is often undeserved and undeniable. And we try to deny it. We just veg out on Netflix or we stay away from it. We avoid it. But God, let this story, the Exodus story, which points to the greater story of Jesus, but let this help us to not avoid it and not be in denial, but to admit suffering is real and it's harsh. And it happens, and we don't need to be surprised by it, but your love is real, your power is just as real there as it is in our blessings. And help us to partner with you to fight against it. And help us to wait for you to deliver us from it. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.